When a budget balances or when a business is thriving, we like to say that things are running in the black. But in the context of America and race, that expression has a certain cruel irony to it. Good morning. This is Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today, still basking in inaugural celebrations for a black president and a national holiday for a black American hero, we talk about a different picture: African Americans and the economy. And it's not always a cause for celebration. Joining us, as they do from time to time, two members of the economics faculty here at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Matthew Forstatter is a professor of economics, director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at UMKC. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
And Linwood Tawheed is assistant professor of economics here at UMKC. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So we'll also take your calls a little bit later. We welcome your comments on the black economic experience. You can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Gentlemen, I'd love it if we could start with some numbers. Paint a picture for us. What is the black economy?
Well, the first striking thing when you look at the numbers is the incredible economic inequality that still exists in 2013 between what in the past has sometimes been called the two Americas. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that there was great inequality historically, and that partly this was driven by legal segregation, legal discrimination. But even after the civil rights movement changed laws concerning civil rights and political rights for African Americans, the economic situation has been very slow to move in a direction of more equality. So, for example, right now, or this is December 2012, in the United States overall, we have the unemployment rate at 7.8%. In Missouri, it's 6.7%. So not quite as high, although you have to be a little bit careful about these numbers because these are rates and they have a numerator and a denominator. So we can get into a little bit maybe about how the unemployment rate is calculated.
So when people stop looking for jobs, for example, they start not being included in the calculation.
Exactly. Right. So you are only counted as part of the labor force if you either have a job or you are actively looking for work, meaning contacted an employment agency or responded to a ad in the previous 4 weeks from the survey. So if you became discouraged, they put you in a category called discouraged worker or labor force dropout. You're no longer counted as officially unemployed. But there is an alternative rate. It's called the U6 statistic, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where they add in some of these people who aren't counted. And in December 2012, in the U.S. overall, the U6 unemployment rate was 14.4%. Okay. Now, as a rule of thumb, you can usually be pretty safe to just double any of these rates to get the African American unemployment rate, or
double.
The African that's right. The African American unemployment rate is always double the white rate, if not the overall rate. Good times and bad.
How long has that been true?
Well, interestingly enough, people will think that it's been true forever. But if you go back to the 1930 census, the unemployment rate for blacks and whites was virtually the same. In fact, there is another rate. It's called the labor force participation rate, which is a count of how percentage of the population who are in the labor force, working or looking for work. And in 1930, the African-American labor force participation rate was actually higher than the white participation rate. Then, of course, 1930s comes, we have the Depression. One of the things that occurs in the research that I've done, and still this is ongoing research, but one of the things that it appears to have occurred is that since there is a more of a competition for work, those who are in more of a position of power, who are better connected in the system, in society in general, are able to secure jobs. And in many cases, they are able to push people who are less powerful in the workforce out of work. And I find that happening not only for low-skilled jobs, but even for the higher-skilled jobs of skilled labor and so forth. So we started to see in 1930 this divergence in the unemployment rate between blacks and whites, getting to the historical doubling and in sometimes tripling in very bad times, but generally in good times, it's no better than double. But it hasn't been the case forever. This is a 1930s phenomena. And I bring that into this discussion because we are seeing an economic effect nationally that is very reminiscent of the Great Depression. And so I would expect that this competition over work is going to exacerbate and we'll see an effect on the black and white unemployment rate going forward.
That's Dr. Linwood Tawheed. He's a professor of economics at UMKC, as is Dr. Matthew Forstatter. Both of them are with us today to talk about African-Americans and the economy. Besides employment, which obviously has a significant impact on almost every other economic indicator, what other disparities are there between African-Americans and the rest of the population, economically speaking?
Well, income and in recent years, one of the indicators that has been of great concern is wealth inequality and what we can do about that. And so there, for every problem, we have a number of proposed solutions. And of course, some of the solutions, the policies that are proposed, are based on very different explanations of why do the disparities persist. Mm-hmm. And so in the case of wealth inequality, going along with the unemployment rate statistics history that Linwood pointed out, some people might think, or some people definitely do believe, that the lower wealth accumulation of African Americans and African American families would be due to lower savings rates among African Americans. That is absolutely not the case.
Huh.
Correct.
So. If it isn't because of lower savings rates, what is it? What perpetuates something from generation to generation?
Well, most people, ordinary people, if you would say, have their wealth invested in their homes. Mm-hmm. And we have a history of discrimination against blacks in this country in terms of home ownership. We have discrimination in terms of ability to increase the capital gains in housing. If you are only able to, for example, to move into neighborhoods in which the housing is pretty much deteriorating, then rather than accumulating a capital gain, you're going to accumulate a capital loss. You never can move into neighborhoods in which there are good public facilities and things that would increase the value of homes. And so even if you're able to buy a home, your investment in that home is going to decrease as opposed to increase, which means your wealth is going to decrease. So there's that history of discrimination which has affected African Americans significantly in home ownership. Again, this is historical, but we have this incident, this current period that we're in, where we have the housing crisis and lots of people are losing homes. A disproportionate number of those are African Americans and Latinos who are losing their homes, therefore losing whatever wealth they have been able to accumulate in the past couple of decades.
I'm sure many listeners are thinking, well, things are tough for everyone right now, but in fact it's a disproportionate effect on people of color.
Right. You say it this way. It's a disproportional effect on those who have less power, which means a disproportional effect on those who have less wealth. And historically, African Americans have had less wealth and less power in this economy than others. The poor are being savaged in general. Yeah. African Americans, Latinos are a large percentage of the poor.
I know that both of you have done research not only on the national and historical aspects of this, but also specifically on the Kansas City mm-hmm. area. Is it any different here? Is it worse? Is it not as bad?
Well, I would say it is as bad, I don't know what answer would give us comfort exactly if we said that it's much, much better here. But in our department partnered with the Urban League of Greater Kansas City to produce the State of Black Kansas City reports for a number of years. The last one we did was was issued in early 2010. And I mean, the numbers are comparable to the national numbers. There's the National Urban League calculates what they call the Equality Index. It maybe should be called the Inequality Index, but in any case, the situation in Kansas City is comparable. And of course, you don't have to explain this just on an intellectual basis to people who live in Kansas City, because just to give you an example, one of the things that we did for the report was to produce a series of maps, and using GIS, geographic information systems, and different color codes, we showed neighborhoods in which there were 80 or 90% or greater African Americans residential, and then different color codes to represent 80 or 90% and above white residential in the neighborhood. And even though it has long been against the law to discriminate in lending or right. in housing and all of these different areas, it is as if you drew a straight line down Kansas City. And in class, when I show this map and I ask the students, what street do you think that is? Every single student knows
right.
that it's Troost.
Right.
So the de facto discrimination and segregation stay even after the laws have changed. At the same time, though, as the residential situation is like that, there has been a troubling development due to what some would think are advances in economic opportunities in the inner city neighborhoods. But the situation, and Linwood really is the one to talk mm-hmm. about this, as he has noted, and I've learned this from him, that actually when there was segregation, when there was in the black neighborhoods, there were small owned black businesses that thrived. And now you have a situation that is quite different.
Yeah, let me mention for our listeners, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. My guests are Matthew Forstatter and Linwood Tawheed, both economics professors at UMKC. We're talking about the black economy, about African Americans and the economy. And I want to invite our listeners, if you have an experience of the so-called black economy, if you've seen or felt yourself inequalities, and if your own experience gives you some insight as to what's causing or sustaining this problem, we'd love for you to call us. Call us at 816-235-2888. We'll take your comments on the air, 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard.org. Dr. Tawheed, various models have been proposed trying to explain how this came to be and why it persists, and also various conversations about what to do about it. Give us sort of a little look at some of the history of that, some of the options that have been considered.
Well, I mean, historically, we could perhaps put a point in time at 1954. 1954 is the time of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. There was no doubt in anyone's mind in 1954 that there was discrimination and racism very active in the country. No one would doubt that. And 1954, in some people's minds, was the end of that process, you know, at least the moving forward. For African Americans fighting for equality in education and quality in employment, 1954 for many becomes a turning point of we finally have the political system, the justice system operating in a direction. There's lots of current debate about the benefits of that politically, but also about the lack of benefit of that economically, because it appears that African Americans have, for various reasons, been forced to kind of choose between political equality and economic equality. Many of the, you know, most of the law of the legal challenges to school segregation prior to 1954, prior to Brown, were about separate and equal. In other words, the folks were fighting not to integrate schools, but to have schools that are funded at black schools that are funded at the same level as white schools. What comes about in 1954 is the process of integration. And that process historically kind of creates a relief among African Americans. OK, we're finally on our way. But it also leads, for example, to I won't say a devaluation of what has already been built in the black community. Matt mentions about black-owned businesses and so forth. For example, particularly in the South, but also in the North, you had women who would want to have dresses, have something to go out for Sunday at church, would go down the street to the local dressmaker. Mm-hmm. Once we have the removal of discrimination in terms of accommodations, and it comes after 1954, when blacks can legally go downtown to a Macy's to buy, then you start to do that. We want to participate in the greater economy, but the side effect of that is that the local black dressmaker goes out of business.
You know, one of the things that I have found really interesting in reading your work, both of you, is sort of the degree to which the things that Martin Luther King talked about, I think we tend to remember the things he said about civil rights, about political inequality.
Right.
We don't seem to remember that one of his major focuses was economic inequality.
Exactly.
Right?
Absolutely. I mean, even the March on Washington, and we all call it the March on Washington, the full name was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And an absolutely central message at that time, but throughout Dr. King's writings, is economic inequality. Not only Dr. King, but many other African-American civil rights leaders, Bayard Rustin, for example, called the addressing of economic inequality the second stage in the movement. In other words, after the gains in terms of political and civil rights, everyone, black leadership, understood that this did not guarantee equality in terms of economic opportunities and outcomes. Mm. Now, in terms of the different analyses, the different models for understanding, and the different solutions that are proposed, we could divide the different approaches broadly into behavioral type models and structural type models. The behavioral models tend to emphasize differences in what economists call human capital, which means skills and education, and also the culture of poverty framework that has long been around, still is popular, whether it's called that or not. In other words, cultural differences between African Americans and whites are identified as the cause of different economic outcomes.
So to that point, we have a comment on our Facebook page, and our listeners are invited to go there and post their comments as well, KCUR's Facebook page. Lori writes, "I see as a problem a lack of higher education in the African-American community. Encouragement for black high schoolers and young adults to reach higher and go further in their educational attainment is necessary." Is that an example of the behavioralist model you're talking about?
Yeah, it's an example of a behaviorist explanation. But there's also a structural explanation of this. And that structural explanation would say that why would anyone invest their time in higher education when higher education is not going to give them the benefit that it gives to others? We're talking about, for example, an unemployment rate in the black community among blacks overall, twice that of whites. And if you then double that unemployment rate, you'll get to a rate for teenagers, for the young people that we're thinking about graduating from high school and going into the job market. Well, they know, they see high school graduates all over the place who are not working. And so does it make sense for them to put that much hope in being able to find a job from increasing their education, when in fact they see these structural barriers? They're not going to be hired regardless of the level of education they have. And so for me, these models create a dichotomy. You have to choose between one or the other. And no complex problem is that simple. There are aspects of all of these things, and we have to address all of these. You can't expect people to act in a way, if everything is against them, then people are going to find other ways to get an income. They're not going to participate in the system. We may want them to, but they're not going to do that. But that's not because they would rather do that. The structure of the system mediates against them. That's not their best choice. And so we have to work on all of these things. None of these models are complete, and you have to have a more holistic approach to this.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say I agree absolutely. And the main reason why I tend to focus more on structural factors in my own work is because of the prevalence of behavioral explanations ignoring of the structural factors. But of course, a holistic model, I absolutely agree. And again, I've been a student of Professor Tawheed on these kinds of issues. But let me just underline what Linwood was saying about the differences to the returns to education investing in education. If you equalize for educational attainment and look at the unemployment rates, the income, and so on and so forth, the inequality remains. So that an African American with some college or college education is only able to attain the level of economic outcomes of whites who have a high school diploma or something along those lines. So this is the problem.
To that point, let's talk to one of our callers. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's where Frank in Kansas City, Missouri called. Frank, welcome to Central Standard.
Pleased to have the opportunity. I'm very humbled to have a few minutes talk to you. First of all, I'd like to say I respect you and I respect your guest, the professors there. I just want to say that I'm just going to hit on one or two things that you all touched briefly. But
Frank, we got a couple of calls behind you, so if you just get right to your point, if you don't mind.
Okay, number one, black community, low economic. I say discrimination. It has been like that since the beginning of the Constitution and still like that. If the playing field were level, then I think blacks would progress more. As a black African-American male, somewhat educated, I've experienced so many things that my counterparts, white Americans, who were less qualified than me, they got ahead. And I say again, I guess if I make the emphasis, it's on the level playing field. It's still discrimination. Just because we have a quote-unquote black president, some things have changed. But you can legislate laws, but you can't legislate human behavior in a person's heart. You gentlemen have a nice day, and I'll continue to listen to your show.
Hey, Frank, thank you for your call. And is that that's the structural explanation, right? That goes beyond behavior to a system that is set up in the problematic way.
Yes, but go ahead.
Yeah, what Matt doesn't mention, there's another set of models, and I would call those biological. The idea that black and white behavior is genetically and inherently inherited behavior. We both reject those models. But to some extent, those who are pushing behavioral models are actually believers in the biological model. It's just more politically correct to say that it's cultural as opposed to biological. But what they mean is that the culture, it manifests itself out of the biology of people. I think Matt and I would both agree, people develop culture in response to the environment. And we're talking about the structure, in this case, driving behavior, and behavior, therefore, affecting structure. And you know, people both of all kinds, all people are in this loop of responding to their environment to get the best out of it that they can. And so, you know, if you have to work harder as an African-American to make an income, the question is, do you have the time to, quote, spend more hours at work? Then what happens to your family? What happens to your children? You know, and so we have these consequences for having this particular structure different for African-Americans and whites.
It's a fascinating conversation about the factors that are affecting African-Americans in the American economy. We'll continue this discussion with our two UMKC economics professors, Linwood Tawheed and Matthew Forstatter, after a break. We want to hear from you. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. You can also email at centralstandard@kcur.org. What are the causes? What are some of the solutions? Call us or join the discussion on Facebook at KCUR's Facebook page. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Stay with us. And welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about the black economy, about the causes of great disparities between African Americans and the general population, and also possible solutions. We're talking with Matthew Forstatter and Linwood Tawheed, both professors at UMKC in the economics department. And we're talking with you, 816-235-2888, 235-2888. About your thoughts and your perceptions about the economic situation that black Americans face. Let's take a couple of those calls. In fact, Joanne in Kansas City, Missouri is with us. Good morning, Joanne.
Hi. I live in the northeast part of Kansas City. We moved there probably about 8 years ago. And what I notice is that I was excited about the community because of the diversity, but after a while, you leave the community for whatever you do. There are no public or charter schools that are meeting state standards. There are only one or two parks. Last month, one of the parks had a drive-by shooting at 3 o'clock in the afternoon where we would walk our dog and take our children to play. There's a library that does one story time, everything else, for children's activities, you leave the community. For decent schools, you leave the community. There are a couple of grocery stores, but there are beggars outside and there's poverty all around. When you have, especially having children or something, you find yourself leaving the community to meet a standard of life. And what happens is we question it all the time. At what point do we just move so we can be closer to the quality of life that we want to raise our children with, that is safe, that doesn't have violence, that doesn't have as many gangs, that has a society, has a community supporting it? And that's kind of what I see, and it's what you were going back with the truth division line. And there are a lot of people trying to make a difference, but it's especially with the economy the way it is, and you get to the point of you're like, when is enough, and when do you just move?
Joanne, thank you so much for that that call. I'm sure there's a lot of folks who feel like Joanne.
Yeah, there are, and quite frankly, I don't fault parents for wanting the best for their children. You can't expect a mother and a father with children to themselves try to balance the good of society against the good of their children. Even though they see what's going on, they would like to be able to for things to be different, but they also have to be parents. But we also cannot ignore the fact that there are structural I don't take the view that the things that are happening are accidental or just a matter of misfortune or coincidence. When we see disinvestment in public schools, this is a long-standing process. We see the emergence of charters and private schools. Milton Friedman, a very prominent economist, many of your listeners may know that name. 1958, writes an article in support of the privatization of schools from an idea that the competition would cause, among schools for dollars would improve education. What that becomes in a society that is structurally capitalist is that there's an opportunity to make a profit on schools.
And we're seeing that.
And we're seeing that. And so there is a disinvestment in public schools, an emphasis for those who want to make a profit on education, which means that schools are being the public school system is falling through the cracks. And the neighborhoods that house those schools are, detrimentally affected by that process. This is not an accident.
Yeah.
And okay.
Yeah, no. I think as we turn then to sort of some of the solutions, some of the efforts that have been made to address these inequities. One of the first thing when I asked you what are the numbers, what state the problem for us, you talked about employment, and we've been talking today about Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King, as it turns out, had a very specific proposal for this problem, and it happens to be a major area of your scholarship, Matthew Forstatter. What is full employment, which was what Dr. King proposed?
Full employment means that every person who is ready and willing to work at the going wage rate, not for $1 million an hour or whatever, that every person who is ready and willing to work has the opportunity for to have a job. And of course, when we get then into more specifics, we also talk about the types of jobs, benefits, working conditions, and so on and so forth. But basically, it means to have an opportunity to work. And, sometimes there's a perception that there's plenty of jobs. Either there's a geographic or a skills mismatch somehow, or that the people who don't have a job must be lazy or uneducated or whatever. So this is absolutely not the case. There are vacancy studies, very legitimate, clear outcomes. Right now, there are over seven unemployed workers seeking employment for every vacancy. That's overall. And then when you go, if the unemployment rate is double in the black community, You can figure it out for yourself. So when you start talking about these issues, it can be overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And you can say to yourself, well, where do you begin? We need more education. Do we start there? We need more. So I have, following Dr. King and many others, focused on job creation, because we haven't talked about the fact that virtually every major social problem that we have is directly or indirectly related to unemployment, crime, bad health, depression, divorce, suicide, dropping out of school. I mean, we go on and on and on. And there's a link between unemployment and these problems. So that's why I feel that job creation and full employment may be the single policy that would have the most all-around benefits.
Okay, but full employment, if there are no jobs, there are no jobs. Mm-hmm. You can't snap your fingers and make employers hire people, or can you?
Right. Well, no, you cannot snap your fingers and make private employers hire people, not in our society.
So what then?
So, okay. So full employment itself does not what we call the job guarantee is where when individuals cannot find work in the private sector or the regular public sector, that they would have the opportunity to work in a community service or a public service employment corps. And in that way, we would, like the WPA of the Great Depression, which was so successful and everyone knows produced so many valuable things, as well as giving people jobs and an income and experience, and can serve as a kind of transitional stage for people to enter back into the regular economy when the private sector recovers and the demand to hire goes up. They can hire out of a pool of people who are working, doing valuable things, learning skills. And we have many, many historical precedents for successful programs like this, not only during the Great Depression, but it more recently, and also in other countries as well.
So federal employment, as of the federal government, is the employer of last resort, if you will, for everyone.
Correct. The federal government has to pay for the program because state and local governments don't have the ability to pay for this type of program the way the federal government does. But the federal government, in our proposal and most proposals I've seen, does not administer and manage the program. That is done by state and local governments or NGOs, not-for-profit institutions. And so that the local situation is much better understood by these institutions rather than having it centrally administered by the federal government.
I have to say I watch the news. I listen to the talk about cutting budgets, about the growing deficit, about efforts to cut spending, not increase spending. This seems politically let's go ahead and say impossible to imagine. Am I right, or is there something I'm missing here?
Well, there is something you're missing. This is much more Matt's area of research than mine, but I want to make a comment and maybe direct your listeners to a discussion that's going on nationwide about a thing called a platinum coin.
Yeah, the $3 trillion coin.
Well, it was $1 trillion. It doesn't really make
a
difference.
Okay.
But by law, the U.S. Treasury has the ability to mint coins in platinum and give them any denomination they would like. So there is a suggestion. It's come out of our economics department, but the last debt crisis fight, it was actually raised on a national level by Ron Paul, the idea that why not use the statue to create a $1 trillion coin and use that, redeem that coin at the Federal Reserve Bank, which keeps count of the debt for $1 trillion and get rid of this debt crisis talk, because the debt crisis talk is phony. It is there is no debt crisis. Matt can talk to this in much more detail.
Well,
why is the debt crisis phony? Why is it not a real – why should we not be treating that as a real thing?
Right, because our monetary system is greatly misunderstood. We are not on a gold standard, so the dollars that we use are not backed. They don't have an intrinsic value, and so there's – no, anything that is technologically possible is financially possible for the federal government, because in the United States, our system is such that the U.S. Government, and when I say U.S. government, think of an institution that combines the Federal Reserve and the Treasury. So the U.S. government is the monopoly issuer of our currency, the dollar. And so there's no financial limit to the amount of dollars that the U.S. government can issue. So that's why the debt limit and discussion of the deficits and all that is, like Lynn said, straight out phony. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, you have to manage the value of the currency. And so
right. What
maybe
would prevent inflation
what really taking? People are – trying to get at is, would greater spending be inflationary? But I mean, then let's talk about that. Let's not say that somehow we don't have the money to spend, as though the United States government would have to borrow dollars that it can create from the private sector or
sure.
tax citizens for
sure.
those dollars.
So let's do talk about mm-hmm. that. I mean, isn't inflation a real risk, and wouldn't that actually take a significant toll on the African American community?
Well, you know, the common understanding of inflation is in some sense not wrong. Too few dollars chasing too many dollars chasing too few goods, right? But the understanding doesn't appear to transform into a process where if you inject more dollars into the system and that dollars produces more goods, there's no reason for inflation. And so we have a situation where we have unemployed persons. They have the ability to produce goods and services. I think of it like this. Back in 1929, we had a $100 billion gross domestic product. Right. You know, it's 15 trillion now, but, you know, 100 billion then. Into the 1930s, right, in 1933, the depth of the Depression, the height of unemployment was 25%. The GDP was $50 billion. It had shrunk to half of what it was. And you had 25% unemployment. Well, the day before the stock market crisis, people were going to work. They were working in factories. The day after, those factories were still there. The people were still there. So what caused, why are we, you know, we still have the ability to produce as many goods as we had before. An injection into that economy of, let's say, $50 billion to employ those people would have produced the same amount of goods with the same amount of currency flowing. There would have been no inflation. We would not have had more dollars chasing fewer goods, same dollars chasing the same goods. Now, if you then go beyond that, when you have full employment and you start injecting money into the economy, now you can't produce more goods, you have more money, now you have inflation. So that's what you have to manage. But when you have less than full employment, injection of money into the economy is not inflationary.
Let's talk with some of our callers, some questions they have about possible solutions and sort of the realities and how current challenges might be overcome with other solutions. Let's talk first with Will, who's in Kansas City, Missouri. Will, good morning.
Good morning. And thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I sort of, and I was talking to the screener a little bit before. I just was curious, one, and maybe you said this already, and I missed it. I'm sorry if I did. But what is the likelihood of employment increase with the increase of education for African Americans? And then the second part of that is, the higher the education, do they find a job that's sort of corresponding to their level of education, or befitting of their level of education? And the point I think I brought up with the screener is my grandfather, during a time when not very many people had college educations, had, you know, an electrical and engineering degree. But his first job coming out of college was cleaning up a movie theater as a janitor.
Yeah, great question, Will. What is the correlation between education and ability to find employment?
Well, let me answer the question this way. We're really talking about two things. We're talking about, one, returns to education. And there is no doubt that among African Americans, those with higher education have higher income. But as Matt said, high school graduate white males have an average higher income than college graduate black males. But so it's true that, you know, the more education you get, the higher your income. So but he also mentions about the connection to unemployment. And so let's put it in this scenario. Let's say we have 10 jobs available. We have 20 candidates. And we insist that the 10 candidates who do not have jobs go out and get a better education. Well, all they can do is displace those who are currently have jobs. You'll still have 10 unemployed. Unless you have 20 jobs, 10 of those, someone is always going to be unemployed. So higher education is not going to solve the unemployment problem, maybe temporarily shift who is unemployed. So we have to deal with both problems.
Let's talk to Sharon in Lawrence. Sharon, good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Great. What's your question?
Well, I was thinking about the education and what you were talking about, and it seems to me that it makes more economic sense in a downturn or in a bad economy to go back to school or to finish school in order to have the degree so that you are more employable when the economy takes an upturn. So, and I wondered if you could speak to that.
Yeah. Matt Forstatter?
Right. Let me make very clear that we are not opposed to education.
Right. It's
we
never a
are
bad
not
thing.
Opposed to training. Those are wonderful things that we support absolutely. The problem is those things alone neither explain the problems and nor will those things alone solve the problems.
Yeah.
So we have to, as Linwood was saying, if you educate and train people for non-existent jobs, then that is not going to work. So we have to both focus on education and training and also increase the total number of job opportunities, as well as there's many other issues that need to be addressed. But in terms of just the unemployment, education, and skills link.
Sure.
So, of course, more education, more training, but also if we continue to train and educate people for non-existent jobs, we're going nowhere.
Right. We have just a few minutes left. We've painted in some ways a pretty bleak picture here. I wonder if there are some glimpses of hope, either nationally or here in Kansas City. We had one writer, Leslie, by email, says, how do you think entrepreneurship fits in the efforts to combat high unemployment in the black community? Are there efforts that you could point to that are positive?
We can point to, certainly in this time, efforts. Entrepreneurship increases during economic hardship.
Yeah.
Because people are out of work and they have to continue to make a living. And so they decide to take their skills and do that independently. Generally, the entrepreneurs who enter the marketplace in that way are not making even the income that they made when they were employed, but they are doing something. In many times, those entrepreneurs will in later times grow into bigger businesses and have good income. You know, so entrepreneurship is also a way for people to earn a living. But it would be better, I think, to do those, not to have that as a solution to an overall, you know, bad economy. So you want to invest in entrepreneurship and development so that people can take their skills and ingenuity and talent and do better than they were doing before, and not just as a way of surviving.
Right. Are there particular efforts in Kansas City that you or directions in the Kansas City economy, just in the 15 seconds we have left?
There is a project that I've been a part of in the city. It was actually initiated and sponsored by our former mayor, Mark Funkhauser, if you remember him. Politically, he was fairly naive, but in this instance, he started a process called New Tools, which has developed into a process that's still ongoing. We have to talk about that at some point. But yeah, there are things that are going on. It's being done by people locally all over the country in response to this bad economy.
That's Dr. Linwood Tauhid, is Assistant Professor of Economics at UMKC. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also joining us to talk about the black economy, Dr. Matthew Forstatter, Professor of Economics and Black Studies and Director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at UMKC. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
You can listen to this episode again. You can subscribe to our podcast, or you can explore any of our past episodes at kcur.org. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton. Kim Noble is our announcer, and Bill Anderson, our executive producer. Tune in tomorrow when we take a look at the ongoing issue around parental school choice. Coming up on Up to Date, a look at the importance of early childhood education and why it ties into developing a strong economy and a new philosophy of online learning. I'm Brian Ellison, and this is Central Standard.